If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Fact: big, high-capacity batteries are the missing link in the green energy revolution. From cars to power plants to wind farms, if you can't store it, you waste it. So batteries matter. U.S. battery company A123 has been a green energy star. It won almost $250 million in taxpayer support from Washington. Now it's in financial trouble. News broke last week that a Chinese company is coming to the rescue. It may end up owning 80% of A123 and its innovations. This hour on Point, green energy, batteries, and the A123 story. You can join the conversation. What is the moral of this story? Do you expect government-subsidized American companies to end up owned in China? Is that okay? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We will go to Asia in a moment and to the heart of America's energy storage battery research effort. But joining me first today from Detroit is Michael Ramsey, automotive reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Mike Ramsey, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be here.
What happened with A123? Why is there Chinese money now on the table?
Well, basically, there's a string of events that turned A123 from one of the most promising American battery startups into basically Chinese property. And I don't think there's anything insidious that happened here. It's basically free market capitalism, and they ended up getting a bailout from the company that was willing to pay them the most money, and that, in this case, was a Chinese company. But what happened was A123 was the first company to build a battery plant in the United States to make advanced electric batteries for electric vehicles, and they received $249 million in matching grant money that was given out as part of a very wide-ranging grant program under the Obama administration that was part of the American Recovery Act.
This was federal money, stimulus money.
Stimulus money, yeah, exactly. And 30-some groups got this money, and 9 battery plants were constructed. Most of them actually were affiliated with much larger companies that had batteries as a piece of them. A123 was one of 2 American companies that did this. It did not go bankrupt. The other one, InterOne, did go bankrupt. And the reason that they did is that they were required to build these plants under the to get the money. They were required to build the plants fairly quickly, and they built the plants, but there's no demand. And in A123's case, they actually had more customers than most of these plants did, but their main customer, Fisker, had a lot of problems launching their vehicle. And when they did launch the vehicle late, and by then A123 was already losing a lot of money, A123 had manufacturing problems and had a very expensive recall that basically put it into the financial position that it's in now.
So you say this is just free market capitalism at work, but I think what has people's attention is that you've got $250 million of U.S. federal government money in the middle of it. And now you've got the prospect of taxpayers having supported, subsidized a company who will be majority owned if this all goes through by a big Chinese firm, Wanxiang Group, that looks like a Chinese competitor to American automakers.
Well, you know, as a matter of fact, that's basically the case. So this gets into the sticky area about how do we treat China versus other companies or countries, rather. China is not a free market. You have to, in order for our country companies to go into China, generally there has to be a 50% ownership, at least in the automotive world. You have to have a 50% ownership by a Chinese firm paired up. So there, in this case, you know, it's one of those things where the problem has to do with it being China, and is it fair for the Chinese to come in and buy a U.S. company and transplant the technology to their country, and especially one that was subsidized by the United States? I don't know. I mean, the regulators still have to approve this, and there's some people on the Hill who have said, what are we doing? You know, how could we let this happen? In the end, I'm not really sure what they can do to stop it.
Well, I mean, it's a political football already, and you can see why. You've got a Romney spokesman saying it's unfortunate Obama borrowed from the Chinese to give taxpayer money to prop up green energy companies that the Chinese are now buying. And what's under people's skin is the idea, you know, American innovation here, government supported, but then sold to a Chinese company. You've got the Cliff Stearns. This is the Republican head of the House Energy and Commerce Committee panel on oversight, talking about the U.S. government being an unwitting accomplice to the theft of our own national secrets. It doesn't sound good, Michael.
No, it doesn't sound good. In fact, I mean, it looks terrible, and especially because A123 was the first. It was the biggest. It was the first. They built this big plant in Michigan. President Obama called in, you know, to the opening ceremony and talked about how this was the dawn of the age of the new battery industry in the United States. And I want to wind it back here. The reason that the federal government did this was not, it was simply because they had been told by many people that the United States needed to establish its own battery infrastructure so that it was not beholden to countries like China and Korea and Japan for all of their battery technology. And that's, you know, so it's, there's some irony here that the reason behind financing the infrastructure has led to, you know, the development of a company that then collapsed and was rescued by a Chinese company, which basically needs this technology because in China there is a real mandate by the government to build electric vehicles, and the demand will be there. And there's also a paucity of Chinese-based battery makers that have the kind of technology that the American companies do.
Michael, is it certain that this deal will go through? It said that it needs U.S. government approval ultimately. Might it be blocked, stopped?
I don't know that I have the... I don't know that I can answer that question. That part of the government is not something that I cover regularly. Certainly it does need CFIUS approval, but that kind of thing happens a lot, and Chinese companies have purchased, including Wanshan, have purchased quite a number of U.S. properties. So I'm not sure whether it can stop or not. The question will be, is it a matter of national security? And, you know, that would be the real thing that they'll be looking at is, are we transferring vital national security property to the Chinese?
Michael Ramsey with The Wall Street Journal joining us today from Detroit. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
With us right now from out Asia, typically normally in Hong Kong, but today we catch him in Jakarta, Indonesia, is Michael Dunn. He's president of the Hong Kong-based strategic marketing firm Dunn & Company. He's spent the last 20 years living, working in China. Writes a lot about automotive, the automotive industry. He's author of American Wheels, Chinese Roads. Michael Dunn, thanks very much for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
Michael, you write some in the Wall Street Journal, and you're one of those who has let out a wail over this transaction that puts majority control of this government-supported American company underneath the wing of a Chinese company. What's your concern?
That's right. Well, from the perspective of China and its leaders, the picture's pretty straightforward. In 2009, China became the largest car market in the world. And it wasn't long before the leaders realized, hey, we're in danger here. We could be on the hook for oil, just like the United States is, and find ourselves embroiled in all kinds of grief and quagmires in the Middle East. We've got to take things in a different direction. So they shortly introduced a very ambitious plan to lead the world in electric vehicles. This is 2009. They said by 2012, we'll have 500,000 electric vehicles running on the roads in China. They offered rebates of up to $10,000 per purchase. They promised to build charging stations in 20 key cities. And it was all hands-on, and we're going to lead the world in electrics. The one ingredient that was missing, the vital ingredient, though, is they do not have the capability to make these advanced batteries that power electric cars. Bottom line, even though they had all the other policies in place, they didn't have cars to buy in China. And today, whereas the target was 500,000 for this year, total sales of electric vehicles will be less than 5,000 in China.
I mean, the U.S.
As a result,
the U.S. has also seen goals set and fall far short. How important is A123 to the Chinese effort to get an effective electric car business up and running?
That's right. They're the missing ingredient. A123, with its battery technology, China sees that as integral and key to launching their demand for cars. If they're able to get a really low-cost, reliable battery from A123, put it into their own cars, then the missing ingredients in place and demand could kick in.
Can this be a win? Can this be, Michael Dunn, can this be a win-win deal for the U.S. and China?
Here's how I see it. Earlier you mentioned access, and the United States is an open door for China and Chinese companies. They can go in and buy at will. The same is not true when American companies go to China. You have many walls to clear, many hurdles to clear, licenses to secure, and for automakers, they can own only up to 50% of their operations in China. So the day that China says there will be a two-way street, whatever we have access to in America, you have the same access to in China, then I can think in terms of win-win. But right now, no. It's a one-way street, and China has all the access.
You say, how can America sustain its culture of innovation when assets are so vulnerable to cherry-picking by cash-rich Chinese companies? Is that what's happening here?
Well, I don't blame the Chinese companies. I don't blame them. They've set their stance, and they're going after the technology they want. They are cherry-picking. They've got subsidized technology. I would rather point out that the United States has a responsibility to not only encourage this kind of innovation, but then go and protect it as well.
Michael Dunn with Dunn and Company, Hong Kong-based, with us today from Jakarta, Indonesia. Thank you very much for joining us, Mr. Dunn. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the United States and China racing over the next big green energy technology piece, new wave batteries, energy storage, and the story of American competitor A123, invested in by Washington, now likely being bought up by a Chinese company. A couple of terrific guests with us now. From Washington, Ethan Zindler is here. He's head of policy analysis at Bloomberg New Energy Finance market research firm there. Ethan, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi there.
And with me in the studio, Donald Sadoway, professor of materials chemistry at MIT, has been working on a very different battery technology, much larger scale vision than the A123 car battery, a big, big figure in research around what many hope, pray, count on to unleash green energy down the road. Donald Sadoway with me here in the studio. Thank you very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
So here we are. I mean, A123 had roots in MIT as well.
That's correct.
And full disclosure, my young daughter plays a very teeny tiny role in one of your labs over there this summer. Okay. Here we are. We're looking at a planet that needs less polluting energy. Batteries are a big piece of that. There are industrial questions here as well around the automotive industry, first and foremost with A123. You're looking on down the road at even larger scale batteries that would have even bigger roles to play. How do you look at the A123 story? You're right in the middle of research here.
Well, I think it's a sad development. It appears that they got to a point in their business model where they were left with no great choices, not enough cash and investor interest to keep them going until they became profitable.
They were trading at $25 a share a couple of years ago. Last week, 50 cents a share. Well, that's investor interest.
That's investor interest. But I think perhaps more importantly, it was a matter of scaling the technology from the lab bench to a full scale that would go into automotive applications at the price point of that particular market. And they were on that path, but evidently they ran out of time.
We're going to talk with you about where the technology path may lead on even bigger scale. But Ethan Zindler, how do you look at this story? That you've got you know, outrage now in some quarters, others saying, come on, we need to stick with this. We need to win in this, and we need to protect American innovation in this quarter. What do you say?
Well, I guess my first thought is that, especially from my perch here in Washington, is that the politics on this is often dramatically oversimplified. The concept of what a quote-unquote U.S. company is and what a quote-unquote Chinese company is is often much more complex in the way it's being described. So we have U.S. headquartered companies in the clean energy sector that do manufacturing in Southeast Asia, and we have Japanese automakers that are making electric batteries. We have one Nissan that's about to start making batteries for electric vehicles in Tennessee. So it's important not to get too nationalistic about looking at these things and to understand that this is a global market and that the great companies, many of the great companies of the world, have operations in more than one country. That said,
Can we pause there for a moment? Can we not stipulate that a company based in Waltham, Massachusetts, with a factory built by the U.S. government in Michigan with $250 million in U.S. taxpayer money in it is an American company?
Oh, I think there's, in that case, for sure. But I would also point out that the U.S. government also gave money to Nissan to help it build a electric vehicle battery plant. And they, frankly, the DOE, the U.S. Department of Energy, helped essentially flood the zone in the electric vehicle market by helping to finance a lot of different players to add manufacturing capacity. And as your first guest referred to, but only fairly quickly, one of the problems that has been facing A123 is actually that there's a lot of the conventional automobile makers that are making these batteries as well. And some of them fairly successfully. GM is certainly out there doing some of this, no question about it, and as well as Nissan, others as well. So it is more complex. I think your point, you know, about it being a U.S. company, there's no question about that. But I think it's also worth noting that, you know, this was the best deal that this company could get at this time. And the fact that it was the Chinese company that came in is a reflection of, you know, what was available on the free market at this very moment. So critics who want more of a free market world and then complain that it's the Chinese company that comes in and buys it, you kind of can't have it both ways.
We don't want to be overly nationalistic about it. On the other hand, we hear Mark Dunn describing to us from, I mean, he normally works there in Hong Kong, quite strong national agenda in China to encourage this line of technology development. I mean, it's not as though nations aren't looking at these and thinking about building industries, Ethan.
Yeah, for sure. But I certainly welcome your fellow guests' comments on this. But my sense is that the technology for making a sort of bog standard lithium-ion battery for use in an electric vehicle at this point is not that sophisticated compared to the kinds of things that he's working on for next generation technology. So my question, maybe for him, and maybe is whether or not, you know, this is, are we really giving away the kitchen sink here by allowing this technology to go to China, or are they simply buying capacity in a market where, you know, we simply have too much capacity globally right now anyway?
Donald Sadoway, you're way out there on research and doing a lot of it. I've seen you on the record in a number of places saying, look, lithium ion is not the cutting edge here anymore. So how do you look at that question?
Well, I think it's not about cutting edge or not. I think the real issue here is cost. This is a very cost-sensitive market, and it's not a brand-new market. The electric vehicle has to come into a market where there's an incumbent technology that's over 100 years old.
Gasoline-powered.
Yeah. Internal combustion has enormous amount of research behind it, enormous amount of commercial experience behind it. And for a fledgling technology to come in and displace that existing infrastructure is going to take more than just being in the ballpark. Lithium-ion technology is still far too expensive for automotive applications at scale.
So does that say to you that the Wanxiang Group in China is misplacing its resources when it comes in to put up millions of dollars into a lithium-ion-based A123?
What it says to me is that somebody in that company thinks that they have the secret to getting over the cost barrier. Maybe they think they've got a way to produce these batteries at scale and to decrease the cost low enough. And that's what I believe A123 was striving to do, was to get the cost down so that the cost of an all-electric vehicle would be competitive with internal combustion. There might be a modest price premium, but not what we see today. So if the Chinese are correct, these Chinese buyers are correct, they've made a wise investment. If they're not correct, then it's not a wise investment.
Ethan, the American CEO of A123 says, you know, this Chinese investment will save U.S. jobs because, you know, you got factories here and U.S. money that will only go into factories here. So maybe it's not an issue of where the jobs are, at least, or is it?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I think in the short run, that very well may be true, and that, listen, A123 raised a lot of venture capital, private sector money before it got government money. And the fact that they couldn't get money from anywhere else at this particular juncture, you know, is a reflection of how, how the market at large viewed them. And I think that, the CEO of the company probably has a fair point, which is that if this is where the money came from to keep their plant going, then this is the best chance that they had. I think longer term, inevitably, it seems that manufacturing shifts to China, and that may be, when the next A123 plant gets open, where it might be is somewhere, maybe not even in China, maybe somewhere else in Southeast Asia. I would want to point out one point about cost. I think he's exactly right that lithium-ion batteries generally have been costly, and that's why when you walk into your dealer showroom to buy an electric vehicle, you're often looking at a price of $40,000 or $50,000. And while you can do the math on how quickly that'll pay off for you, it's often 5 or 10 years down the road. And so what you have are people buying electric vehicles who are of a certain means or a certain political persuasion. But I will say this, one thing that our firm has looked at is that the amount of electric vehicle capacity, production capacity that there is around the world right now and the demand. And the fact of the matter is that we are in a very oversupplied market. And so what's going to happen...
Oversupplied really with what? With what, Ethan?
With batteries. There's far more manufacturing facilities out there to build batteries than there is demand for these batteries right now. And so the inevitable trend, and we feel very strongly that this is going to happen, is that the price of a lithium-ion battery is going to drop quite dramatically. And as that happens, actually, electric vehicles are going to become a lot more affordable to a lot more people, and that's going to help out a number of the players in the industry. But the reality of it is that we are in an oversupplied market for electric vehicle batteries right now.
When that day comes, we'll see who owns what. Don Seto, I want to come to you on that, but let me get a couple of callers here, if I may. Danvers, Massachusetts. John is listening and calling in. John, thanks for your call.
Thank you, Tom. I own two manufacturing companies in Massachusetts, and what troubles me is the transition of the technology and then the manufacturing to China. This is the second battery company that I'm aware of that is now moving to China. The first one was, I believe, in central Massachusetts, and they were going to establish a manufacturing facility in Massachusetts for 200 to 300 jobs. They couldn't get the support. They moved everything to China, and now I've heard that the company has actually been sold to the Chinese. So my concern is we transition, we outsource the manufacturing now, we outsource the technology next, and what are we left with? Well, certainly in Massachusetts, not a lot, the service industry. So there's a fundamental issue, and this is just sort of the next step. And I thank you very much for the show, and take your comments off the air.
Thank you so much, John. And let me get one more, John, in Westboro. Thank you. Westboro, Massachusetts. John, your answer.
Well, I want to take up the very premise of this program, the one that draws a listenership, and that is the premise that there has to be a war, a competition, that there's national security, national secrets, and that we have to be wary. Now, some of your guests have pointed out that this could be a win-win situation. We have a company we put money into. It's going out of business. It provides jobs. The Chinese are willing to take it over and provide more green energy. And in addition, you see, I think a lot of this way of looking at the world is driven by the fact that, we're an imperial power. We want to control much of the planet. The Chinese don't look at things that way. And I think we would be well to start to look at things their way, in a win-win way, rather than this confrontational warlike approach.
John, I take your point. I mean, I raised the question myself about whether this may could not be a win-win situation. On the other hand, there's no question China has its own agendas. It's a big power, too. I don't know exactly how to characterize its global view here. Don Sadoway, here you're doing high-end research, and there's research that flows all over the world. It's not only the United States, not only China. Europeans, no doubt, working on this stuff, too. How do you look at the issue of national boundaries? Is that something that you pay little or no attention to at the high end of research? Do we have to have it in mind because it's tied to economies somewhere down the line?
Well, I think at the research level, it's an open market of ideas, and we look for colleagues wherever they are on the planet. When it comes to the commercialization of the technology, if it's done with private capital, I think, again, it's wherever the capital comes from. I think what makes this particular conversation thorny is the $249 million that was given to the company from the federal government not that long ago. And I think that's what complicates matters here.
But, I mean, here we are in an age when perhaps like our caller John just now, people are eager for green energy to have a more dominant role ultimately on the planet. Many people want government to be looking to nurture this way forward and not just to leave it to the tender mercies of a market where, fossil fuel prices can block the way relatively low, though the gas prices look high right now. I mean, do we not need government support for this, or should we just leave it all to the free market?
Well, I think that it's going to need some form of assistance because the time scales are so long and the amounts of money are so great in order to take a technology in the energy sector from the lab bench to market that relying on commercial investment may be overly optimistic. And if we see that there's a national security imperative here, then there is a legitimate role for government involvement.
Ethan, there's our first two callers. And the first, a manufacturer himself, says, look, if we lose our manufacturing and we lose our technology innovation edge, what do we have left? Our second caller says, it's good for the planet if we have advances in green energy, and let's look at it as win-win. Can you hold those two views simultaneously?
Let me try and answer the first one, and then by the time I'm done, I'll probably have forgotten what the second one is. You can remind me.
Win-win.
So the first one, though, I mean, in terms of competitiveness, I think it is it's a fair point, and I think one of the challenges, this is beyond clean energy, is for the U.S. is to be a global competitor in manufacturing. And I think the reality of it is that as the world becomes more globalized in terms of manufacturing, it's very challenging for the U.S. to keep up once a technology has essentially become mature and can be produced, from almost anywhere at potentially lower cost in other parts of the world. The key, of course, is to stay ahead of the game and to continue to develop new technologies that are cutting edge and are homegrown, and then to enjoy some of the benefits here. But I think the reality of it is that to expect that, the fifth or the tenth manufacturing plant that you build with a technology that is no longer cutting edge, to expect that that can stay in the United States may not be realistic. This is the way of the world. And so the key for the U.S. is to continue to be innovating, coming up with newer technologies that are always on the cutting edge and being sought after. And I might really take issue with the question of whether or not A123's technology at this very point in time truly is cutting edge. There are a number of other companies, like I said, that are doing more or less the same thing, including some of the world's largest automakers.
Well, gosh, that goes in the blink of an eye. I mean, Don Sadoway, it was like day before yesterday that the federal money was put in, and it was trumpeted. We heard the president himself saying it's cutting edge, and now it's not cutting edge? I mean, where is this edge that we're trying to find and keep and hold of value that we can build an economy on, Don?
Look, it's a fast-paced race here. There are people all over the world that are working on variants of lithium-ion technology, and as Ethan says, there are some other companies out there that have some competition here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the next big green energy technology piece, new wave batteries that can store energy produced by all kinds of alternative energy sources. It is a key factor in the future of moving away from fossil fuels. We're looking at the story of the American competitor here, A123. Washington invested in it. Now it's getting a big investment from a Chinese company, and there people are just scratching their heads about what exactly this means. Donald Sadoway is with us. He's a professor of materials chemistry at MIT, a big mover in the onward frontier of battery research and technology. Ethan Zindler joins us from Washington, head of policy analysis at Bloomberg News, New Energy Finance, excuse me. It's a market research firm there. Listen, Don Sadoway, so here's lithium ion. You know, people saying, well, it may not be the cutting edge anymore. Maybe what's going to China isn't the hottest, biggest thing in any case. All right, it still leaves us wondering about the investment, whether it was too much or there should have been more, or it was just the wrong stuff to begin with, or they just didn't get it off the ground quickly enough, or people are saying there's not enough demand yet because, as you say, the expense is still a little high. Help us look over the horizon at the next frontier of where battery research is going, beyond the mobile battery and the automobile even. What's coming?
Well, I think there are two separate markets here that are quite different. One is the automotive, anything to do with mobility, and it has its own set of metrics and performance requirements. And I think lithium ion is not the best technology for that particular market, and I think we need to go beyond lithium. And this isn't just my own opinion. The DOE has a series of meetings on an annual basis. There was one in June mm-hmm. of this year out at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, and the consensus there was that lithium ion just isn't going to make it.
Is it happening, this move beyond lithium ion? Is it happening in the U.S., in Europe, in China, anywhere?
There's a herd mentality in the research community that has got lithium ion as sort of the sole focus. There's a tiny, tiny amount of research going beyond lithium ion, and even mm-hmm. that involves variants of lithium, lithium air, lithium sulfur. And now you get down to the fingers of one hand the number of research groups that are looking at non-lithium chemistries. And I think that's where we have to go, and I have some desires to work in that area.
Meanwhile, electric car sales are not going anywhere like people had hoped.
Not going to because, you know, let's face it, if the batteries were affordable at the price point of that market, mm-hmm. the cars would be selling. If the problem is cost, then you got to get the cost down. And lithium ion, don't forget, this technology came out in the early 90s.
Yeah.
This is not...
It's not hot off the griddle anymore.
This is a 20-year-old technology. Mm-hmm. Granted, people have been refining and looking for alternatives in terms of one of the electrodes, but it's a 20-year-old technology. It's time to meet the metrics of the market. But then the other major market is what you alluded to earlier, which mm-hmm. is stationary storage for grid-level applications. And it goes actually beyond even the whole question of trying to deal with the intermittency of solar and wind. But large
stationary storage for grid application. Define what you mean there.
So, I mean, the simplest example is wind. Wind is fantastic. It's green, but it's random. And so if we want to have... wind contribute to base load, not
where you can count on it.
You
where
can count
always going to be there,
and it has to because the grid has no capacity to store the electricity that's powering this broadcast was generated just moments ago. Mm-hmm. So if the wind starts blowing, either we use that electricity or we have to.
If the propeller, the turbine's not turning, there's no juice.
Right,
you got to store it somewhere to have it when you need it if you want to get it into the grid.
So you need batteries, and they have to be big, and they have to be cheap. Same goes with solar. Even though you know what the time of sunrise and sunset are, well, what happens on a cloudy day? You need to have some way of ballasting that intermittent supply, but it goes beyond that. There are all sorts of times on the conventional grid mm-hmm. where you have enormous price volatility because of spikes in demand and the inability to deliver electricity to the site. So, for example, a place like Manhattan, there's adequate power generation capability, but it's not on the island. Mm-hmm. And you can end up in a situation where you have huge demand in Manhattan.
And
you
the
have
cables
the supply.
Aren't big enough to get
exactly.
it in there.
Exactly.
Or a server farm somewhere, I don't know, that needs a whole lot of juice in a hurry.
Exactly. So this whole business of transmission line congestion can lead to price spikes. If you had batteries on the island, in the basements of skyscrapers, you'd level out that price volatility.
You're talking about batteries that might be the size of shipping containers.
Yes.
What you'd put down in that basement. What would be in that container?
Well,
that's what are you working on?
Well, there are different approaches, and they're quite different from lithium ion. I tell you one thing that won't be in there is lithium ion.
Okay.
So the approach that I've taken with my group at MIT is to look at something that's more akin to the production of metal as the production of aluminum by electrolytic processing. And so these are batteries that consist of liquid metals.
Molten salt. Give us a little science lesson here. How would one of these work?
So you have three layers that consider salad oil and vinegar separate.
We can do that.
Two liquids. Mm-hmm. Well, imagine now you got three liquids, and they separate. So you've got a low-density liquid metal on the top as one electrode. You've got a high-density liquid metal on the bottom of different composition, obviously. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in between, this is a high-temperature system, might be running 400 or 500 degrees centigrade. In between, instead of an aqueous solution, an acid or an alkaline solution, you have a molten salt. And these three phase separate, and the metal doesn't dissolve in the salt, and the salt doesn't dissolve in the metal. And
you get the equivalent of poles on a battery in the flashlight.
The top layer is acting as the negative, and the bottom layer is acting as the positive. And the top layer wants to dissolve in the bottom layer. And the only way it can do it is by becoming ionized, which liberates electrons. They go through the external
circuit.
That
is juice. That's power.
That's your power. And then when you go to charge the battery, you pull that dissolved metal out of the bottom layer and bring it back to the top. And you can do that over and over again.
So this could be massive batteries, the kind that would light up a skyscraper sitting in the basement if they needed to.
Correct.
Is that within range of production, application?
Well, it's certainly successful in the laboratory, and there's a startup company that's based on this technology here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that's now building batteries of capacity 1 kilowatt hour, a single cell that's about the size of a diameter of a pizza, about 4 inches thick. And the plan is within 2 years to have stacks of those size cells that can deliver substantial amounts of electricity.
Ethan Zindler, what are you thinking as you hear this? Is this, this sounds great for green energy. Does it sound great for American industry, like a new American industry?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that you guys raised a very good point about the need for power storage on the grid as we move towards more renewable energy sources and the variability of those sources. I think that's an inevitable challenge, and I think, you know, whether it seems unlikely that lithium ion batteries that's the purpose for them. But
right.
I would also, again, just want to come back to one thing on electric vehicles, which is in the solar industry, a very interesting thing has gone on. We've seen a tremendous amount of investment in all kinds of fascinating technologies that use new materials to make solar cells. And a number of the companies are, you know, in the Boston area and out in Silicon Valley. And all kinds of interesting attempts to drive prices down through new technologies. But at the same time, in the solar industry, we saw this sudden massive ramp up in the manufacturing of conventional solar panels using the conventional silicon technologies. And guess what? That's driven down the price of a solar panel to well less than half of what it was just a couple of years ago. And there's potentially more declines to come.
So you're saying the Chinese could drive price down with scale rather than with the necessarily the best technology?
I'm saying is there always can be a very interesting race between new technology development and just sheer economies of scale.
Yep.
And in the electric vehicle market, we have yet to see the economies of scale to kick in terms of helping the consumer. It's kicking in to, certainly to hurt companies like A123 and other battery startups. But the price decline that is due to come will probably help consumers and also help pick up electric vehicle sales. As you rightly note, those sales have not met the expectations of the auto industry. And yet, electric vehicle sales, we've still seen a higher rate of adoption among electric vehicles than we did of, say, the Prius hybrid electric when it was first rolled out.
Yeah, well, and we see what it is now. Let me get a call, if I may, from Idaho Falls, Idaho. Rich is calling. Hi, Rich. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Hey, I was listening earlier on, and I thought I heard that A123's competitor, who also received bailout money, one of the stipulations of that bailout money was that they put manufacturing capacity online.
In the U.S., you mean?
Yes. And so my question is, if maybe this is just a basic economics question and our government getting overzealous and flooding the market with capacity, which brought the price down, which is forcing these companies out of business.
Well, I mean, they did want factories. I mean, I think the money went in A123. It went into the construction of a factory in Livonia, Michigan. That was the first one. There was another one planned. But I don't know. Is there overzealousness at some point here, Don?
I think it's not about overzealous. I think the effort was directed at trying to accelerate the scale-up and also to accelerate the decrease in the selling price of these batteries. And it's all about the price. And if those batteries were cheap enough, people would be buying them. And this is all about the failure to meet the expectations of the market.
Or maybe we can scale up and get that cheaper price in Livonia or in Shanghai.
If you start looking at cost-based analysis of the various components of the manufacturing process, you might get to the point where you hit a plateau and you're not going to get any cheaper. There's an assumption that if the wages are low enough and so on, that will continue to decrease the cost of manufacturing. But at some point, you've got the capital cost of the equipment. You got to pay your workers at least something.
Mm-hmm.
And you may get to the point where when you've got all of the efficiency squeezed out, that product is still too expensive for that particular market.
Maybe there's still...
Could jump in on that, Tom. I think that will happen, certainly with the lithium-ion batteries, but we're some ways away from that. There's a good deal. I mean, we've done our own forecasting of prices, and we expect the price to drop by half over the next sort of 4 or 5 years or sooner even. And yes, eventually you do reach the end of the so-called learning curve where things start to flatten out, but we're quite a ways from that, at least in our view, on lithium-ion. If I could, though, just to go back to the caller's initial point in question. A lot of the money that was given out by the federal government was grants to actually build manufacturing plants.
Right.
There have been a number of them that have sprung up around the country. My only point I would make is that I think that people always want a very quick kind of answer of, did this work? Are we a leader? You know, was it money well spent? The jury, to some large degree, in my view, is still very much out. I think, you know, if you look at a company like GM, which is making the Chevy Volt, which hasn't sold at quite the numbers that they originally had hoped, but is now showing signs of picking up, and you look at the Nissan Leaf, which is going to start being produced down in Tennessee, you could make an argument that the U.S. is actually playing a very important role in facilitating the growth of electric vehicle production and sales, but we really have to wait and see to see if it's going to be the U.S. that is the leader or whether it's going to be some other countries that are. But by no means do we know the answer to this question definitively at this point.
Let's go to Chesapeake, Virginia, and David. David, thanks for calling. You're on.
David, thanks. thanks for taking my call, Tom. I'll try to be brief. I think batteries have been around for hundreds of 100 years or more, and the storage capability of storing even longer. I think really, in a nutshell, it's just a move by the industry of the oil and utilities to suppress the the battery industry. Their progress and bringing it to the market. I mean, it's easy to say from a capitalist side that, oh, well, it's going to be too expensive. Well, that's because it hasn't been introduced early enough and soon enough to the United States market to bring that cost down like what we do with everything else. I mean, we can put a TV in the size of a watch and have a communication device all in one, cell phone, everything.
But, David, what do you want? I mean, the government was apparently trying here, right? They were trying to goose it forward with their $250 million that they put up.
Well, it looks good. I mean, it looks good like they're doing something, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're doing it for the better. I mean, we've got solar that's failing. You know, how long has solar been out? Nothing is getting done because the oil and the utilities industries, it's a huge threat to them.
Yeah, David, thanks very much for that. If I may, Don Sadoway, I know you've got venture capital investment into your research. You've got oil companies investing in your research. How do you see what's unfolding here on this front, both in terms of the planet's need for less harmful energy and in terms of this country's need for a healthy economy?
Well, I don't see that there's any kind of an attempt on the part of either the energy industry, say the conventional electricity generators, or the oil industry to restrain progress here. As you point out, many oil companies, in fact, are investing heavily in solar and diversifying themselves as energy companies. And it's not just trying to find a sweeter term to put on the
marketing brand.
No, it's they're genuinely trying to make money in solar, and I do have money from an oil company that's supporting some of the research on campus and also some of the investment in the startup company. So they're serious. They're not doing it as an act of charity. They want a return on investment.
Is the breakthrough coming? Will the economic fruit of it be shared by Americans?
It's always dangerous to try to predict the future, but I think that I've never felt more optimistic about the chances of major discovery, certainly in the area of grid-level storage. And I think that there's room at the top in the area of automotive storage. And yeah, it's true that batteries have been around for 200 years, but if you take a look at the total amount of money that's gone into investment in the basic research and the size of the research community. You know, Bill Gates refers to the total IQ. If you have a small community of 100-200 people that are trying to schedule a breakthrough, you got much less chance than if you got 1,000 or 2,000 people. We're now starting to get those large communities of people, physicists, chemists, material scientists, put all that together, and we're going to make the breakthrough.
Ethan Zindler, do you think the economic fruit will land in this country or elsewhere?
Too soon to tell, I think, but I think I just certainly caution anybody from looking, being myopic about this and just focusing on one case or another. I think that the U.S. government has made some long-range bets in this area, and whether or not those pay out, we won't know in the next 2 weeks or 2 months or even 2 years necessarily.
It's a big critical factor in our future. Ethan Zindler with Bloomberg, Donald Sadoway of MIT, thank you very much to you both. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.